The old expression, "don't let the truth get in the way of a good story," is often attributed to Mark Twain, which helps secure his place as one of our great American folk philosophers, and is probably also a lie in its own right. But why shouldn't it be a lie? Isn't that the point? The fictions we create about ourselves often reveal more truth than the facts can. Why else would we keep turning to music, poetry, and art for guidance and meaning? That beloved Southern Gothic writer Flannery O'Connor once said, "I write to discover what I know." Another celebrated Southern author, Eudora Welty, put it this way, "Writing fiction is an act of discovering what you believe." And for Joe Henry, the great songwriter, producer, poet, and creative force who was profoundly influenced by both, you might say the same is true. One shouldn't let the facts stand in the way of the truth. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Joe Henry's identity was divided between the South and the North as a boy. Born in North Carolina, he spent time in Georgia and Ohio before his family settled in Michigan, which is where he came of age. This sense of being pulled between two poles put him on a path of discovery early on, a search that was deepened by his close relationship with his older brother, Dave. Together, they conspired to uncover the raw material that would later inform much of Joe's work. He describes his childhood as one of awe and enthusiasm for music, books, films, all part of an ongoing exchange between two brothers looking for a way out, or at least a road to something else. The road that stretched from north to south, from rural to urban, from black to white, from the facts to the truth, was the one he traveled, and he did it with focus and intention. There's a line that Joe Henry said to me that I haven't been able to shake. He was talking about being in the studio, holding space for musicians as a producer, but it applies to just about everything. He said, "Total presence, that is the code of my road." And when he said it, I felt something click into place, because presence, real presence, is harder to achieve than meets the eye. That might be why Joe Henry's work hits as hard as it does. His songs and his productions are steeped in a kind of poetic clarity, deep, mysterious, often spiritual, but always grounded in the moment. Over the past four decades, Joe has quietly helped shape the sound of American music from the inside out. Since the late 80s, he's released more than a dozen solo albums and worked with artists like Alan Toussaint, Mavis Staples, Solomon Burke, Bonnie Raitt, Ani DiFranco, Joan Baez, Michelle Indigocello, and many more. He's known for his intimate, textured, and somewhat shaggy production style. He favors recording live in the room with minimal isolation and maximal humanity. He also co-wrote the hit "Don't Tell Me" with Madonna, who happens to be his sister-in-law. And more recently, he's been writing and recording with John Batiste. As a songwriter, he's always preferred storytelling over autobiography. In fact, he rejects the idea that confession is the highest form of honesty. He told me that in songwriting, your factual experience can be disruptive to the truth you're trying to allow to move through you. And that line stayed with me too, because it says so much about the kind of artist he is. Not just telling stories, but channeling something beyond himself. He even co-authored a book with his brother about the life of Richard Pryor. Joe and I got together not long ago at the Washington Square Hotel to talk about growing up in the Midwest with deep Southern roots, about what it means to carry cultural memory in your DNA, even as you try to outrun it. We talked about his early obsession with Randy Newman and Bob Dylan, about learning to write in character, about the influence of Southern Gothic literature, Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor, and how he came to see himself as part of that lineage. We talked about his decades-long musical relationship with T-Bone Burnett, who mentored and guided him through countless situations. We talked about producing records and how being a good producer has less to do with telling people what to play and more to do with being present, listening, and creating a space for something real to emerge. We talked about Ornette Coleman, about faith, about illness, about the song that started playing in his head the day he was told he had 7 months to live, and about how songs arrive, often without warning, and the discipline it takes to follow them without trying to control where they're going. And finally, we talked about America, what it means to be an American songwriter in 2025, at a time when the story of this country feels increasingly fragile and the sun is beginning to set. But as he wrote in his song, "Civilians," life is short, but by the grace of God, the night is long. Life is short, but by the grace of God, the night is long. Joe Henry's songs offer a kind of resistance through devotion, through presence, through poetry, and above all, through truth, no matter what the facts may say. Third-story.com is the place to see the full archive, hundreds of deep-diving conversations like this one, with other seekers, searchers, and soothsayers. If you enjoy this one, you might check out the episodes with John Leventhal, Larry Klein, or Daniel Lenoir. Check out my Substack for the latest dispatches, episodes, and musings. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios to find out more about all their award-winning content. Here's me and Joe Henry talking it down.
Are we live now? So I can.
We are now. Now anything that you say
can and will be
documented. Documented. Yeah.
Yeah. When I first moved to New York in '85, I moved with my brother Dave, with whom I had lived my entire life up until the weekend before Melanie and I got married. And from the time I was probably 11 and he was 13, you know, we were sharing friends. You know, he's been the most significant person in my life for a long time and for many reasons. So I was already dating Melanie, who I'd known since high school, and she'd moved here 6 months before Dave and I did. And we lived a block apart in Park Slope.
Were you not together at that point?
We were, but we just weren't living together.
Yeah.
She had moved and she had a roommate right above the post office in Park Slope on the 7th Avenue. And then Dave and I lived a block away on 1st Street and 7th. And the weekend before Mel and I got married, we went back to Michigan to get married because both of our parents were still there. Dave and I sat up one night in our apartment over a bottle of wine and divided the books and record collection that we had been amassing in tandem since I was, you know, 10 and he was 12.
Man, thank you for starting us off that way. In preparing to talk to you today, I kind of checked out as much material as I could, and I wasn't able to read the book that you and your brother Dave wrote about Richard Pryor, but I was able to read the introduction. And in the introduction, you and Dave set up a question that has kind of been hovering over this conversation for me. And you also kind of lay out your childhood together. You get the sense that you were these two brothers who were just consuming as much as you could as your family moved you around the country. At one point, you find yourself in a suburb of Akron, Ohio. Is that where you
were?
True. You describe it as something between suburban and podunk, kind of. But you're consuming whatever it is, SNL, comedy records, music, and you're kind of waking up to the world together.
Yeah. And Dave's a writer. So, you know, he was handing me the first books that were important to me. And he was bringing music into the house, even though I had my own discoveries. I bought my first 45 hunk of wax with my own money, you know, when I was seven.
Seven.
It was Glen Campbell's Galveston, something that's still incredibly meaningful to me.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston.
You know, people say, what's embarrassing music that you loved in your early life? I was like, I don't have any.
Yeah.
My second hunk of wax was Dusty Springfield, Son of a Preacher.
Based on what, the cover? Why'd you choose what
No,
you chose?
Because I heard it on the radio and I was completely seduced.
Yeah.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.
The first LP I bought with my own money was Johnny Cash Live at San Quentin.
Wanted man in California. Wanted man in Buffalo. Wanted man in Kansas City. Wanted man in Ohio. Wanted man in Mississippi. Wanted man in Old Cheyenne. Wherever you might look tonight, you might see this wanted man.
And then at the point when I'm, you know, maybe, you know, 11, Dave hands me Slaughterhouse Five by Kurt Vonnegut to read. It was the first book that I felt like, this is mine. It means so much to me. We're living in Milford, Ohio at this point, just north of Cincinnati. And I joined one of those record clubs, you know, 10 free records for a penny if you commit to, you know. And Dave's looking over my shoulder as I'm picking the 10 albums I'm going to buy. And he points to one that he's just read a review of in Crawdaddy, which was a rock mag at the time. Randy Newman's Good Old Boys, which had just come out. And Dave said, oh, that's supposed to be great. You should get that. And that record was as important to me, remains as important to me, you know, I was just writing with Robert Hilburn, the ex-LA Times writer who has a new Randy Newman biography out. And I just sent him a note how much I enjoyed it as I devoured it. And I said, nobody, with the exception of Bob Dylan, meant more to my formation than Randy Newman and what I understood through the lens of that one album.
You looked like a princess the night we met, with your hair piled up high. I will never forget. I'm drunk right now, baby, but I've got to be. I never could tell you what you mean to me.
What did it give you permission to do, do you think?
Write in character, to think like a filmmaker, like a novelist. You know, that I wasn't, even though I was coming of age in the day of the so-called singer-songwriter, the confessional, the more honest you're willing to be about your own life, that is that much better a song, which I completely reject. I think honesty is overrated in that regard.
I know you seem to feel that honesty can stand between a song and the truth.
Exactly. Your factual experience as a writer can be incredibly disruptive to whatever truth you are trying to allow to move through you.
Mm-hmm.
The experience that's waiting to happen to you is really different than the experience that you're trying to hand somebody else. And I somehow instinctively understood listening to Randy Newman. I never for a minute believed that he was from Birmingham, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
I understood that he was operating, for all practical purposes, like Eudora Welty.
Right. And I think that there is something in your approach that there's almost like a Southern Gothic element in what's happening, because it's tied to a deeply Southern tradition of storytelling.
It's really interesting that you say that, Leo, because at one point in the not too distant past, I think when an album called Reverie was just coming out, and I was still living in Los Angeles performing at the Largo Theater, and I went with the band that made the record and performed it in total on the day it released.
Sticks and stones, blood, ash, and bone. I shake a tree, swim out alone. Turning over the dark Missouri now that every new leaf I have is gone.
We were living at the Garfield House in South Pasadena at the time, where I had a studio in the basement for that decade.
Legendary studio.
And sitting out under the blue Atlas cedar with Melanie and my son Levon the next morning, talking about the evening. You know, Melanie has known me since she was 15 and I was 16, said, I don't know why, but it didn't occur to me until last night listening to you that you're a Southern writer.
Yes.
She said, I don't know why I didn't put that together before. I said, I don't either, because from the time we were first married and living in Brooklyn, when I couldn't sleep, what did I do? I had a cassette player next to the bed, and I played a cassette tape of Eudora Welty reading The Petrified Man over and over.
I was getting along fine with Mama, Papa, Daddy, and Uncle Rondo until my sister Stella Rondo just separated from her husband and came back home again, Mr. Whitaker. Of course, I went with Mr. Whitaker first when he first appeared here in China Grove taking Pose Yourself photos, and Stella Rondo broke us up. Told him I was one-sided, bigger on one side than the other, which is a deliberate, calculated falsehood. I'm the same.
I don't know how else I could have telegraphed that that's where I came from. But to be fair, I hadn't really thought of myself as belonging to that tradition. I knew I had nourished myself in that tradition, but I never thought to include myself at the table.
Never thought to include yourself at the table because you were writing songs and not writing...
Probably because I was writing songs.
Yeah.
And those people, Flannery O'Connor and Eudora in particular, were also from such another era that I didn't really feel necessarily allowed to think of myself as being part of their atmosphere.
You were born in North Carolina, and you make reference to your father who had come to North Carolina from somewhere else?
Well, he was born in Tennessee,
uh-huh.
but he grew up in Charlotte. And my mom was born at her grandmother's house in South Carolina, but her parents lived in Charlotte also. So both my parents were essentially born and raised in the Charlotte vicinity.
And I read that you refer to your father as having been raised on a dirt farm.
Yeah, very poor people, not growing food to sell, growing what they needed to eat. You know, he carried a rifle to high school, left it in his locker, and hunted squirrel and rabbit on the walk home. That's where he came from.
So even though you were sort of moved out of that environment pretty quickly, I mean, it sounds like you came of age actually in Michigan more than anywhere else.
Oh, I consider myself so much more, or I've wanted to think of myself so much more a product of the Great Lakes area. I'm very resonant with Michigan and what happened to me there. And because I'd moved so often, Leo, Michigan was the first place I made the friends that I would still have now.
Yeah.
Michigan was the place where I really felt myself individuate as the person I recognize myself to be now. But it doesn't mean that I've been able to expunge the Southernness from my DNA, even though I tried really hard to.
Did you? Because I was going to say, I think it's a common story of people who, when they leave their home country, they find themselves more connected with whatever the sort of folk roots of wherever they came from.
Well, Hemingway went to Spain, and what did he do? He was writing about Upper Michigan.
Yeah,
I was so embarrassed by what I knew of the South that I grew up in. I was born at the very end of 1960. I still remember the public pool in Charlotte. I don't know at what level it was enforced, but it still did say whites only above the locker room at the public pool. You know, he was only president for another month, but when I was born, Eisenhower was president.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't put me in a time and place, I don't know what does.
Yeah.
I know where I came from, and I know why I was eager to distance myself from everything I knew about the South that birthed me.
Yeah. Interesting, though, because, like, again, going back to that little chapter that you wrote with your brother in the introduction to the book, you grappled with the question of whether or not it was for you to tell the story of a Black icon.
Were we allowed?
And the conclusion that you came to was, first of all, that all of that Black American and Southern Black tradition had found its way into the white influences that you had been absorbing. Dylan, Randy Newman, for sure, just a countless number of your kind of heroes, and realized that they had been completely imbued with the Black Americana.
I was saying to Melanie just the other night, it came up in conversation. I said, you know, the people that really sparked things for me when I was very young, and I can name three off the top of my head, Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, George Jones, all told stories of being mentored as boys by Black street musicians. I got into a terse conversation one night. I'm having dinner with who was my brother-in-law at the time, the British filmmaker Guy Ritchie. He means to be provocative. And he started a conversation. We were at Christmas in their country home in England. And he said to me over the table, just being provocative, he said to me, Mr. Henry, he liked to say when he was being serious, you know, what have Black Americans offered your country? Mm. I said, you mean beyond every single thing that matters to me?
Everything that we've exported to the world.
Everything that has its roots for me back in a blues tradition that has rippled through not only all the music that I love, but has its reverberations in all the writing that has meant anything to me, all the literature that has meant anything to me. It's inescapable.
I had a conversation years ago for this podcast with a jazz saxophone player named John Ellis, who's a good friend, and he grew up in North Carolina also. And he talked about how when he moved to New York, what he realized is he had more in common with what he called country people than he did necessarily with white Northerners, meaning it didn't really matter if you were Black or white. If you're from the country in North Carolina, he could relate to you more deeply than he could if you were, you know, the same race as him, but from, you know. Your story is a little bit different because you left earlier.
Yeah.
But I think there's some truth in that, even maybe going back to whatever your parents brought with them when they went to the North.
No, there was a certain, and remains a certain understanding I have of anybody who's from that particular part of, not only of the country, but of that particular part of the Southern United States, different from Oklahoma, Texas.
Yeah.
I don't even think of that as the South.
Yeah.
But my time in North Carolina, and from there we went to Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta when Dr. King was killed. Mm. He was killed in Memphis, but his church was in Atlanta. His family was in Atlanta. In my time that I was working with Harry Belafonte, talked so often. You never had a single conversation with Harry where Martin didn't factor. That was his closest friend in life. Mm. He had made a dedicated pledge to Dr. King to live a life of nonviolence. And Harry would say to me, "That's not my instinctive mode." Hmm. That was his understanding of how we had to be. But it took a lot for me to maintain that posture. And sure. I found my ways to push back against it and still honor that pledge. I had the experience when I first started working with Harry. He was working on the documentary of his life. And it was in a state that he was deeply unhappy with it. And I was initially brought in, would you help him with the music part of it? But when I met him on the first day, I went to his apartment in a snowstorm, and we'd brought Levon to town for a new school audition. And I was asked, would I go spend some time with Harry? It was just after Barack Obama's first inauguration, in matter of fact, a week or two after. And, you know, we got into a conversation because I was watching this cut of the film with him matching Lazy Boy chairs in his living room. And the film footage that I saw as a boy on TV in Atlanta when the funeral march is happening a few miles away from where I'm living at the time, I don't understand that I have a visceral memory in my body of seeing that man whose name I did not know walk through the streets singing and weeping, leading the funeral procession.
Yes.
Until I'm watching that same footage in the room with that man and lost it to the point where he paused the movie.
And you're there to produce him, theoretically, and he's having to
produce. And he puts his face, that face that looked shockingly the same, right in front of mine, and said, "Are you okay, brother?" Mm. And he said, then he told me that I was. He says, "You're all right.
Yeah.
You're okay." And I needed him to tell me that.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't know I was carrying that around. I didn't know I understood the way that it imprinted on my person.
Okay, so you brought it up. Your ex-brother-in-law was Guy Ritchie, because you have been married to the same person since 1987. It's a long time now.
Yeah, this is almost 38 years.
And you met in high school age. You know, you got married in 87. Mm-hmm. So her sister, who everyone in the world knows is Madonna, was already iconic at that point.
At the time of our wedding, she had just crossed that Rubicon from being a New York and thus an American star to being an international star, because Like a Virgin had just come out.
You were kind of starting your recording career around the same time, right?
Was.
So the entire length of your career as a performing musician and as a composer and as a producer has sort of happened in parallel with your sister-in-law, who had this one in a billion kind of career. Over the years, you've collaborated a little bit. There's one particularly famous story where you wrote a song, your wife sent the lyric to her, and she re-recorded the song, basically. Yeah. But what has it been like for you? Because that's the biggest example of what pop success could look like.
Pretty much.
And you have your own path that hasn't necessarily, it doesn't seem like, overly pursued pop success.
No, and it was problematic in that my future father-in-law at that moment didn't know any professional musician other than his daughter. Mm. So he looks at me and thinks, that's what you're trying to do and you're failing miserably. And I have to tell him, look, you got to understand, she and I are not in the same line of work.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to play, you know, at that time, the Pontiac Silverdome, which is long gone. I'm not trying to do that. There's really no connection between her ambition and my own.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to be a celebrity. I'm trying to be a really good musician.
Yeah.
And there's a distinction. Sometimes really good musicians become celebrities, but they are really different pursuits as far as energetically what your ambition is, what your intentionality is. I'm not trying to be that.
Yeah.
I'd like to do well. And if I'm able to, it'll be because I'm doing something that's uniquely my own. I was naive enough then to still believe that would carry the day.
Yeah.
But it was really difficult for a while, because every interview that I ever gave either began or ended with what I used to just refer to as the question.
Yeah.
Things got easier for me as time went on, because I had enough of a body of work where she was not a part of every conversation. And at the point when we started writing songs together, and I think we've written five together at this point, there was actually a professional answer to the question. Yeah. And I said, you know, I'm happy to give you a professional answer to that.
Yeah.
I'm happy to talk about what my collaborations with her professionally have been like. That doesn't give you access to my personal relationship to her.
Sure.
So there are aspects of that I don't mind talking about either. They're real and they impact my life in tangible ways. Like I would talk about anybody with whom I have worked and with whom I also maintain a deeply personal relationship.
Yes.
Which has been a lot of people. You know, I don't come out of every production project with a new friend for life, but I've come out of a lot of them with friends for life.
You know, you talk about working with Harry Belafonte, one of many incredible, iconic artists who you have had the privilege of producing and collaborating with. So many of the artists that you have produced are some of the greatest American songwriters. And you as a songwriter know what it is to be produced and make a record, but not all songwriters make good producers.
True.
And not all producers make good songwriters. Every now and then they overlap. What do you think sets you up to be a good producer in addition to being a good writer?
Well, my working philosophy as a producer, and I came up decidedly under the wing of T-Bone Burnett. I don't know if I would have thought about being a producer for anybody else had he not actively enlisted me to be his second, you know, his acolyte at a point after he had just produced a record for me. And I don't know why he thought I would be good at it. He's a kind of mystical figure in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I could spend this whole time telling you stories of when he's just intervened in ways that I don't think he understood why he was, why he showed up in my life in a particular moment that I most needed him. But, you know, what I learned from him was just sort of the way that people, when they know they're being heard, and you can translate this to other aspects of life beyond music, when people know they're being heard and respected and loved, they will open a vein for you. They'll give you everything they've got. It's like if you read the Tao and it says, you know, the master leads by inactivity. Like, I don't know that I do anything other than be fiercely present. It's a seance. You know, somebody has to show up to make sure the lights are low enough, the room's warm enough, and that people don't forget to hold hands around the table. Well, you know, whatever that is. I interviewed Rodney Crowell on stage last night. He said that when I produced him the first time, that he had a unique experience and that he just wanted to please me. He said, I never worked with a producer that I wanted so desperately to please you. I was aiming what I was doing at you.
Time is jammed and flying fast. The brakes are bad and the potholes are up. I'm out here running from the past. What we had was not enough. Heard she just touched down in Hollywood. And her friends all say she's looking good.
I saw a film clip once of Sinatra in the studio recording. It was a very good year. And he's in the room with the full orchestra, and he's got folding chairs set up for about 10 friends who are drinking wine out of paper cups and sitting there. And he's aiming the performance at them. And I realized, a friend of mine who's a writer said, singers sing different for you than for other producers. What's your secret? I said, I don't know if it's a secret. I just sit in the room where they can see me. They know I'm not on the phone. They know I'm not answering email. They're not going to come out of the booth and I'm going to say, hey, how was that? I had to be out of the room, but let's have a listen. I sit where Bonnie Raitt.
Dr. Feelgood, sleeping on a concrete bench. Can I get a witness?
Or Roseanne Cash.
It's all coming back to me now.
Or Mavis.
Death is slow, but death is sure. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Death is slow, but death is sure. Hallelujah, hallelujah.
Or Irma Thomas.
Your love is like a chunk of gold.
Or Ann Peebles.
Love just left with my heart across its shoulders. Every step I grow colder and colder.
Or whoever can see that I'm actively engaged. And they will give you everything. Mm-hmm. You can't stop them from doing it. You know, I don't know why it happens exactly. My wife managed Daniel Lanois for a dozen years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was my proximity to Dan. And I, at some point, pushing back on Dan's enormous success, I'm going, you know, he has a sound that he runs everybody through that same haunted house.
Yes.
And if Dan, if you're listening, no disrespect intended, I honor what you do.
I spoke to him about it a couple of years ago. I want to tell you what he told me when I asked him about it.
I said, I'm not interested in having a sound.
Yeah.
To which my wife, Melanie, said, if you don't think you have a sound, you're out of your mind. I just don't know why I have one, because I don't ask anybody to do anything. I just invite them into the space that I hope will be like safe space for everybody. And then it happens.
You do make choices, though. I mean, whether it's working with Ryan Freeland and in your studio, or Husky Huskold before
that. Yeah, I know that sounds... I know I was sounding really evasive not to acknowledge that, of course, I'm making choices. Nonetheless, I witness things happen, and I don't know why they're happening other than I'm standing here doing no other thing than listening, and people understand that that's happening.
I mean, I have that experience sometimes talking to people where I think I haven't even asked a question yet, and the person just talking. So maybe it is just acknowledging that you're with the person when they're talking.
That's what the filmmaker Errol Morris said, documentary filmmaker. He said, I never know what I've gotten. I'm so busy using so much of my attention to look like I'm listening that I'm not able to actually listen. And then I get back and I run the footage and I go, wow, they told me everything.
Yeah.
Because I looked that present.
Do you think maybe part of that Rodney Crowell wanting to please you is also knowing that not only is he performing for a very present and engaged listener, but he's also performing for a present and engaged listener who he admires as a songwriter himself?
I would be disingenuous if I didn't acknowledge that I think that's was going on.
Yeah. And maybe part of your credibility when you walk in the room is your own personal work that you've continued to do all this time.
Well, I present myself as a musician, as a songwriter, first and foremost. And when I'm producing records for other people, I'm a songwriter producing a record. That's still how I think of not only what I do, but who I am. I do think that part of what happens in my production life, it happens because I'm a musician first. And I've witnessed that, like, for instance, when I was working with my great friend and mentor, Alan Toussaint. I remember the moment when he came in from a take, excited about what had just happened, and moves directly to Ryan Freeland and said, hey, if that's a decent take, there's a spot I needed to fix. And Ryan said something like, oh, you mean that third chord in the second verse? I already fixed it. I grabbed it from the third verse and
flew it
in. And he said, how did you know to do that? And I just said, he's a piano player. Yeah. Once Alan registered that this man who had recorded him, he was a piano player. He's like, oh, so here forward, anytime you hear that, you'll fix that.
Yeah.
And Ryan said, sure. All right.
Yeah.
How I saw his regard for Ryan shift, not only because the sounds were so great, and Alan had commented on that too, because he's a record maker. He was the Mac Daddy producer in New Orleans at the point. But understanding that Ryan was a musician first changed everything.
Alan was a record producer, so not only are you producing from time to time songwriters, but also other producers, and you've also allowed yourself to be produced. I mean, you learned how to produce, I imagine, by watching T-Bone and other producers.
Sure. T-Bone was the last producer I ever had for myself, and I learned that from T, this idea that you don't tell anybody what to play. You be a good casting director, and you allow people to feel supported and safe. Music will happen.
Yeah. And you seem to share a common philosophy in terms of setting up close, allowing leakage, a kind of a sonic philosophy. But I also understand that you're not afraid of Pro Tools, that you're not afraid to go.
Oh, no, I do anything. I'm not precious about any of it. Yeah. I'm not a purist or whatever that means.
Yeah.
I don't blanch when somebody wants to tune a word or edit something, fly something, you know, whatever we can do to make whatever's coming out of a pair of speakers move somebody is completely fair game.
Yeah.
I mean, look, if you go to see a film and somebody's hanging off the edge of a cliff, I don't need to think that they're really doing that for this to work on me as far as narrative. It's all fair game. It's just, is it musical? Period.
Yeah.
And I've been really fortunate. You know, you bring up my relationship to other producers. There are people who started off as a musician, songwriter, who then transitioned into being a producer and stopped doing those other things.
Yes.
I don't know many people who continued to maintain a life as an artist while they were also actively being a producer. I can name two that I know of, and they were both mentors to me, T-Bone and Alan, who share a birthday, by the way, which I think is...
When is it?
Not interesting. January 12th. But the fact that I instinctively engaged myself on you know, ongoing basis with people who were being record makers in total met me where I needed to be met, because I stopped hearing a song just because I'd finished writing it and I could sit on the edge of the bed and play it for you. I was already thinking about how it was going to be recorded. You know, I don't think of them as separate enterprises. It's all an extension of finishing something.
But to that end, is there a right way to produce a song or a wrong way?
If there is, I can't tell you what either of them are, other than the right way is to allow the song to become what it means to become.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if it's what I thought it was going to be 10 minutes or 30 minutes ago. Nobody happier than me when a song has enough character of its own to insist on its identity.
Yeah.
Like, I really thought this was going to be that. And then all of a sudden it stood up and identified itself in one way or another as being wholly, no, I'm on this other side of the room.
Yeah.
And I have a different name than you thought I did.
Yes.
I'm thrilled by that.
Yeah.
I think there are very few people. Prince was an anomaly. Prince seemed to understand that there's a way that this goes, and I'm going to have it. And if you can't give me what I need as a bass player, fuck you.
Sure.
I'll play it. Go.
Sure.
I know what I'm doing.
Sure.
This is my path. He's a rare bird
yeah.
that way. I think there's all kind of ways a song can be successful.
Yes.
Our job is to just pick one of them and be fully committed to it. We recorded these same songs. Now, I get through with an album project, I might think, we could have recorded these same songs in the same period with the same musicians, but if we'd have done them in a different order, it would have been a wholly different record, because what we decided here influenced what we then decided there,
yes.
and what we heard there changed the way we thought about what this song's job needed to be,
yes.
or how it might exist in this movie that we're making. I just learned to not be dedicated to anything other than finding a way to embrace what is already happening.
Yes.
Look for the moment of drama in every song and amplify it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's providing more space and silence. Sometimes it's things getting bigger and wilder. Whatever that is usually being told to me by the process. Look, I got plenty enough ego, but my ego, as it turns out, is perfectly sated when a song moves somebody. It didn't have to be my idea. I'm not a producer who, you know, when a musician pipes up with an idea, take them out of the room, because I've seen it happen, and say, hey, next time you have an idea, you tell me.
Yeah.
And if I think it's worth anything, I'll announce it to the room.
Yeah.
But it's like the mob boss. You're going to come through me. You're not going to get a shot at the title.
Yeah.
I don't feel that way at all.
Yes.
Anybody I've invited to the room is not there just because of the instrument they play. I want their whole humanity. I want their whole experience. If Jay Bellerose has an instinctive response to a song, I don't want to have blown it by already telling him how I hope he's heard this.
Yes.
If Mark Rebo has an idea, I want to know about it. I get one chance for him to have a response before he's asked me what I think. And that's worth everything to me.
Yes.
And as soon as you tell people the idea that you have for them, they can't unhear that.
Yeah, and you work with a large collection of great musicians and collaborators, but there is something to be said for those sort of like lifers. You know, you seem loyal in a lot of ways. You're loyal to Jay.
I'm an incredibly loyal person. I'm loyal to Jay. He's one of my very closest friends outside of my immediate family. I don't know anybody else who does what he does. He's my favorite person to have a steak and martini with at a bar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just happy in his presence. And I don't invite him into a project because I need a drummer. Who should I get? I just understand that I want his person in the room. And sometimes his version of playing drums is not playing drums.
Yeah.
You know, when I made the record called Gospel According to Water, I mean, that was just supposed to be demos. It was going to be one day, then it was two because I invited more people in and they needed to learn the songs. But I didn't even listen to playbacks. I just played, and when I got through it successfully, I look around the room, we're all right. Look at Husky in the other room, we're fine. I'm moving on. I didn't think of it as a finished record until I got home.
Husky Huskoltz, who's one of my favorite engineers of all time.
And at that point, I hadn't worked with him as an engineer in about 20 years.
So Husky offers you some studio time, and you've got these songs.
Well, I gave him a piano.
Oh, well, that's a fair trade.
Yeah, and he said, hey, if you need anything. And I said, hey, by the way, I do, actually. I have a new batch of songs that I'm afraid of forgetting, and I need to at least document them so I can listen, see what they are, and I need to give them to my publisher. So, hey, how about if I just come over for a day? I just blow through everything. That'd be a big help to me. And then I said, oh, by the way, I'm bringing Patrick Warren. No worries. Oh, by the way, I'm bringing John Smith. And as it turns out, Levon's in town. But that's still the agenda.
And no drums.
Because Jay was on tour with Allison and Robert. Uh-huh. But I bring this up to you now, Leo, because when I had those recordings and I decided there's no point in redoing these, what they seem to want to be is already sort of happened. Nonetheless, I sent all of them to Jay. And I said, hey, listen to this, if you will, and you know, see if there's like four or five that you hear yourself getting up on. And when you get home, you know, we'll go after it. He left me a long voicemail from the road, basically just saying, JH, I've probably listened to this whole thing about a dozen times in my bunk on the bus. I play any of this music live with you anytime. I wouldn't touch this, and I hope you don't let anybody else touch it.
Yeah.
I hear this is completely finished. I hear this is being exactly what it's supposed to be.
Yes.
And I still should have listed him on the album liner notes as having played drums.
Yeah.
Because that's what he had to offer as a player, was protecting that space.
Sure.
And I took him at his word, and I decided that he was right.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could have heard that from anybody.
This little we can leave behind will truly mark this earth. But treachery and love are ours to keep for all their worth. The flower of our rise, it is a bloom, blood dark but clear. You hold it in your open hand to carry on from here.
I've seen Jay sit there and play take after take of something. And I go, oh, it's all in the room. It's right here. It's just about landing. Let's just play this one more time. Take goes by. Jay doesn't strike a note.
Yeah.
And I just said, JB, everything okay?
Yeah.
He said, oh, yeah, great. He said, I just understood if that was the take, whatever was happening did not need me.
Yes.
It's not like he's refined this thing and I'm going to, and now I'm on autopilot of I got my part together. I'm just going to keep hitting it as long as everybody else is hitting it.
Yeah.
He's always listening at that level.
Yeah.
And understanding that, you know, where I came in on the last take, we got to that moment, it didn't need me.
Yeah. The album, The Gospel According to Water, that's the collection of songs that you recorded after your cancer diagnosis?
Yes. That was me writing my way out of some very dark woods.
Looking back on it, do you think there was anything different about that batch of songs than the previous dozen records?
In ways, yes. I never wrote that many songs so fast. I never had been as conscious as I was that I needed to be doing that, that my life kind of depended on me doing it.
In what sense?
In the sense that I had been invited to have no hope that I was going to survive. I'd been told I had 3 to 7 months to live. And then another doctor told me he didn't think that was true at all. And yet, I found myself paralyzed until song returned to me. I was driving in a car to meet a friend, and I did that thing I've only witnessed in a movie and didn't think it was true, where I started to hear a song, words and music, and I pulled over to the side of the road and sang a verse into my phone so that I wouldn't forget it, because it could have been just been like a, you know, a fish swimming by your boat. You know, there'll be other fish, but I don't know if you have another shot at that one. And because I'd been bereft of song.
What song was that?
In Time for Tomorrow.
I came here for the funeral of all sorrow. Last
last in line, but in time for tomorrow. When next of kin will begin their rowing to claim the hat that fell while you were bowing to all the stars.
So normally song, when it comes to you, it comes out of a structured experience of sitting down and saying, I'm going to write a song right
now. Not necessarily. It frequently begins by something that just trips a wire and I hear a phrase.
Yeah.
You know, I have a song called Our Song, and I was getting ready on July 3rd for my family to travel to Upper Michigan to see my in-laws the next day. I was running around in LA running errands. I didn't have time to write a song, but I was driving. I can remember where I was on the hill approaching our house, and just heard in my head, I saw Willie Mays at a Scottsdale Home Depot. I didn't know to what that referred, but it felt spring-loaded, and I had to work really hard not to let the cork pop out of the bottle, because it happens one time where you just kind of get the raw resource, and I had to keep it close enough it wouldn't go away, but I could not allow it to unfurl in a moment when I was in no position to deal with it.
I saw Willie Mays at a Scottsdale Home Depot, looking at garage door springs at the far end of the 14th row.
Man, I was thinking about that lyric and about how songs with imagery that don't necessarily refer to a specific thing, or maybe they do, or, you know, that we have all, as listeners, all of this agency to imagine and interpret the way we want, keep taking on new lives. Like in that song, Willie Mays is overheard to have said to his wife, this used to be my country.
His wife stood there beside him. She was quiet and they both were proud. Gave them room, but was close enough that I heard him when he said out loud, this was my country, this was my song. Somewhere in the middle there, though it started badly and it's ending wrong.
In the framework of the conversation today that we're all having, this used to be my country, those who foolishly have elected this monster believe that they were voting for or supporting an idea of what their country used to be. I don't know what they think that is, but and here we are looking at what we think our country used to be. And I heard that lyric the other day as I was listening to your records, and I was thinking, God, that strikes me in a particular way right now that it couldn't have possibly been to you when you wrote it, because from a long time ago.
As long as I can possibly stay ignorant about what is happening in the writing process, I'm not trying to anticipate where it's going, because as soon as I think I know what it's trying to be, then I find myself leading it, and that's not a better outcome than just continuing to be dutifully taking dictation as long as I can.
Taking dictation from the
from wherever that happens, from however atmospherically that moves through a person. But I knew that we were criminally at war in Iraq, and it was the 4th of July, and my country was asking me to celebrate who we were, and I did not have one idea how I was supposed to do that.
I see. And that came through you.
Yeah, but I didn't understand when that line just offered itself up that that's where that was going.
You were raised in the church?
Mm-hmm.
Are you still religious or spiritual?
I'm deeply spiritual. Yeah. I don't identify myself as a Christian.
Yeah.
I have learned a lot from many spiritual traditions.
Yeah.
I have a really close friend who, at the point when I knew him, was an Episcopal priest in Pasadena leading a politically active parish.
A political Episcopal priest in Pasadena with an active parish is a good tongue twister.
That's quite a sentence. You know, he says, Christianity is my language, just like American English is my language, but do I think that that's how everybody in the world ought to speak?
Mm.
Do I think that's the only way to communicate? Absolutely not. I have a lot of respect for people who proclaim themselves to be Christians. My parents, first and foremost, that's not my language.
Yeah.
You know, I had to say to my beloved late mother when my parents came to visit when Levon was like 10 days old. I walked into the kitchen one afternoon and Melanie and my mom are talking and my mom is weeping. And I understand that the conversation that I've interrupted is my mom expressing some very genuine sorrow that she understood that her new grandson would not be raised in a church, yeah. would not be offered that foundation that for her had been absolutely fundamental to her person.
Yeah.
We got to have the conversation, and I'm grateful that she didn't hear it as me being flip or dismissive in any way of saying, Mom, I don't think that we are out of alignment in any way.
Yeah.
But what you get from the Apostle Paul, I get from Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, that's how I understand myself being a part of something bigger than I am. That's what connects me to my humanity. It's a different dialect, you know, because of my wiring, but our impulse is not different.
Yes.
Our desires to be decent people, making our way as we can in this lifetime is not fundamentally different.
Well, you found music. I mean, that yeah. you found another
music
avenue.
Was my way.
Yeah.
You found another way.
Yeah.
Our roads are parallel and they yeah. don't, and they are not, there's no dissonance for me
yeah.
between your path and my path.
Yeah. I love that. It's just different language to try to tell the same story, more or less, or versions yeah. of this, of the human story.
Yeah.
So we sat down to set this up. You were talking about New York. We're having this conversation in a Village Hotel, which I have to say, because I associate you with a kind of form of American storytelling and American iconography, to meet in the West Village in a hotel, in an old classic New York hotel.
What my friend Joan Baez famously referred to in the song as that crummy hotel over Washington Square.
Now I see.
It's a little bit nicer than it used to be.
I have to say, I was almost disappointed when I walked in. It yeah. was a little cleaner than I was hoping it was going to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, it's been gussied up but in the last few years, I gather.
But when this was the location that you proposed, I was delighted. Because if you're going to interview Joe Henry in a hotel room, please let it be this hotel.
Not lost on me why you would make that connection, because it's no leap. You know, it is the way that I schooled myself, or the way that I got schooled. I can still remember where I was standing in our parents' house when I was 10 or 11, and Dave, in the adjoining room, there's a landing that connected our bedrooms upstairs, when he dropped a needle on a Bob Dylan record.
Do you know which one it was?
Sure I do. Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits, Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
And he dropped a needle on whatever side opens with All I Really Want to Do.
Mm-hmm. I ain't looking to compete with you, beat or cheat or mistreat you. Simplify you, classify you, deny, defy, or crucify you. All I really wanna do is baby be friends with you.
And I stood there in the hallway between our bedrooms, in my memory, not moving, but somehow understanding that everything was now different. And that I would be looking through a lens that was now connecting the dots for me between the other music that I was obsessing over, and very particularly narrative songs.
Yeah.
Songs that really, even if obliquely like Ode to Billy Joe or something, nonetheless is storytelling.
Yes.
Of course, I believe every creative act, from the cave paintings to somebody making a quill, it's all storytelling.
Yes.
Every bit of it.
But Bob Dylan is not only telling stories in the songs that he writes, he's telling stories in his own life, in his the presentation
his persona
of who he
is. Yes. A story.
Yes.
You know, and it doesn't make it untrue because he was making shit up on the fly.
Yeah.
You can't possibly burst that balloon for me.
Yeah. No, sure. As a matter of fact, I think you had to grapple with it as anyone would have to, because there is an implication that you're going to have to tell some story about yourself at some
yeah.
point. You're going to have to invent yourself now.
What I heard out of Bob was purely invitational.
Mm.
And it wasn't an invitation to be like him.
Mm.
It was an invitation to be free in the way that I understood him to be free.
Yes.
But it didn't hurt at all that very shortly thereafter, I'm getting that same message from Charlie Parker and Richard Pryor, for that matter, in ways that were equally vivid.
Well, right. In jumping ahead, I mean, there's a story that I want you to tell me where you wake up in a dream or you have some sort of a hallucination in which the word Ornette appears to you.
It was a waking dream. I was writing the song, even though it is in first person. I'm driving a car again. I can remember where I was getting off at the exit and where we lived in South Pasadena, off the 110, oldest freeway in America, and heard the beginning of what became Richard Pryor, Addressed to the Tearful Nation. Somehow, understanding that it was Richard speaking, I don't know what told me that, but I just sort of understood that I could decide that that's what was happening and that there was energy in that acceptance and I was just going to follow it because I was fascinated by it.
Sometimes I think I've almost fooled myself. Sometimes I think I've almost fooled myself. Spreading out my wings above us like a tree, laughing now out loud and almost like I was free.
And I immediately had the thought that this is like a languid blues, but it's not like a rock blues. But I was thinking this wants to be a blues, like an Ellington kind of orchestral blues. And if that's the case, then I feel like I need somebody who can represent Richard's full humanity, his chaotic nature, his inventive nature, his deeply personal, loving nature. And I remember thinking, you know, I need somebody like an Ornette Coleman. But it didn't occur to me in that moment that I could get Ornette Coleman. Nothing made me think that I could attract Ornette Coleman.
Isn't that interesting?
To be on my record. But the very next day, I'm talking to the man who was at that point my entertainment lawyer, who was based in New York. At the end of the conversation, he just says, "Hey, by the way, you'll never believe who I'm having lunch with tomorrow. Ornette Coleman." I said, "No kidding." He said, "Yeah, he needs some help with something. And why wouldn't I go have lunch with Ornette?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Look, I don't want to get in the way of whatever that might become for you. But if things go well in this conversation, I need you to get a letter to him for me."
Yeah.
And so I got busy writing a letter because all of a sudden there was an avenue. And I get a call from a woman who worked for Ornette. And she says what I expect her to say, which is, "Look, it's very sweet of you. Ornette doesn't do this. He's been asked by everybody in the world."
Yeah.
"And he feels like to say yes to you and say no to other people, it's like he's judging the music." Yeah. "And he doesn't mean to do that." And I said, "Okay." So I started writing a letter to Wayne Shorter. But before I can finish the letter to Wayne Shorter, I get a call back from the same woman a couple days later and said, I'm really shocked to be writing you." I'd also included with my letter what was my current record at the time, which was Fuse. And she says, "Ornette spent the weekend listening to your record and he says he understands exactly why you would want to work with him and he'd be delighted."
Hmm.
We recorded the record, other than the orchestral elements in Ornette, in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And it was really interesting to record that song with a band that included Brad Meldow.
Is Blade on that
Rebo,
record?
Blade.
Yeah.
Two drummers on that track.
Yeah.
Brian and Abe Laborial Jr.
Who spent the last 20 years as Paul McCartney's drummer.
Exactly. But it was really interesting to record with this idea that nobody knows what he's going to do, but we understand that Ornette at some point is going to walk through this, like Hitchcock passing through a scene.
Yeah.
He's going to walk through. We have to hold space for whatever he might do.
Yeah.
Even if at the last minute Ornette had backed out, he would have already impacted what happened. Because I was imagining, how do I hold space for him?
Yeah. Create space that he could fill.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a dozen years before your Richard Pryor book. So Richard Pryor has been on your mind throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, and it was the song that led me to be invited by, I think it was Esquire. I'd written something for them before, and somebody got in touch. When my publicist was asking them to, if they would review the record, you know. They came back and said, well, we could, or we could just give him the space, and he could write about Ornette and Richard and how the idea of writing about one led him to work with the other.
Hmm.
So I wrote a piece for Esquire about Ornette and Richard.
Yeah.
I finished the song. I'm on a label that's owned by Disney, who's terrified of Richard as a specter, as a volatile, even though at this point Richard's living in Encino, strapped into a wheelchair. And they basically said to me, you got three choices. You can change the title of your song, which I couldn't do because that tells you how to hear it. I never mentioned Richard in the song. You can leave the song off, you can change the title, or you can get Richard's permission.
Oh,
enter again, mystical T-Bone Burnett. Stormy night in the wintertime in LA, just torrential rains that year. Everybody in the household has got a flu except me. T-Bone calls on a Saturday night. Joey, what are you doing? I don't know, T-Bone, what am I doing? He said, hey, meet me and Ben Benders for dinner at Musso and Frank's. And Melanie said, go, you should get out of this house. This is a sick house, get out of here. So I go, there's a whole table full of people. And I'm in these conversations, and at one point, because I'm in this quagmire with Disney, you know, spending money with a lawyer I can't afford to argue with them about this.
Mm.
It's like, I got a song on the same album, by the way, called Edgar Bergen. You're not asking me to call Candy Bergen and see if this is okay. But here, we got a problem all of a sudden. So I'm sitting at the table, and I finally, there's a couple comedians at the table. And I say to the table, hey, any chance anybody here knows Jenny Lee Pryor, who was Richard's ex-wife at the time and gatekeeper? And T-Bone's in deep conversation with them or somebody, and just wheels around and says, Joey, I've known Jenny Lee for like 25 years. I mean, what do you need? And I quickly break it down for him. You know, we're a couple martinis in, and he says, Joey, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of this. In fact, it's already taken care of. I'm thinking he won't even remember this conversation tomorrow. The next morning, T calls me and says, hey, I just spoke to Jenny Pryor. They're waiting for the song. So go burn them a copy of it, call a messenger service, and get it over to them. And as quickly as this car could have driven in this rainstorm to Encino from my house in South Pasadena and then listen to the 7-minute song, my phone rings, and it's Jenny Pryor. You know, Richard's moved, I'm moved, what do you need? You have it.
Yeah.
So then I end up writing this piece. Richard reads this piece, or it's read to him, and Jenny Lee says, look, Richard's been approached for years and years about making a film of his life, and he's never been ready, but he thinks he might be ready now. He wants to know if you'll write the screenplay. And I said, I'm not a screenwriter, I'm a songwriter. And she said, well, I know, Richard doesn't want a screenwriter. He likes how you write. I called my brother Dave, who is a screenwriter, and say, Dave, this is on spec, but do we want to go work for Richard and give this a whirl? We did. Years go by. Jenny Lee Pryor, out of her mind, pulls a plug on the whole thing. And then I consult with Kathleen Brennan, Tom Waits' wife, who was a script reader for Coppola. And she just says, just write her out of it. Make sure that all the information you have, you could get somewhere else than, other than her. And then so Dave one day just says, look, Leo DiCaprio has films he can't get made. This could never happen. Why don't we just write the book? And we can say whatever we want.
I love that, because I have to tell you, I personally have suffered in the last year a couple of huge defeats with projects that were attached to people that had the ability to pull the plug. And I'm walking around literally today thinking to myself, I don't want to be in anybody's hands with my work.
Yeah.
There's always the possibility of a bigger payoff, which is why we do it, I think, or why it would be attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But the frustration of devoting what could be 10 years of your life to a project that could never get made is just too defeating to me.
Well, I just realized that Jenny Pryor, God bless her, was a serial meeting taker. She didn't want to take the big check and then be out.
She wanted to be in the game.
She just keep taking meetings. And she had a history of bringing things to fruition right to the threshold of a production happening and then starting over.
Yes.
We didn't know we were caught up in such a
But in the end, you got a book.
And ultimately, but you know, years went by.
Yeah.
It took years. It happened because of the song, because I was forced to get his permission.
When we sat down, I started to talk about this, meeting you at this hotel. You told me that you sort of started your married life and your family mm-hmm. in living in New York, that your first move, big sort of professional move, was actually to the East Coast, and you tried to
yeah.
make a go of it in New York originally, and you
I
did.
I was here for 5 years. It was not an easy time. It was not a songwriter's world in any way. And I was signed to a label who was having some success. I got signed to Profile Records, which were having enormous success with Run DMC. The guy who owned that label thought he was going to be David Geffen, and I'm going to sign everything. I'm going to do all kinds of things. They didn't have one idea who I was and no interest in who I was, as it turns out. It was a hard 5 years.
And that's the period of the first three records?
No, it's the period of the first one I made. I still lived in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
It's a glass in the corner. It leaves from the hollow. It's a ship and a battle. The saucer still wrapped up in paper, and a mark on my face. I don't know how it happened.
And I made my second album, which was called Murder of Crows, up in Woodstock. I was signed to A&M at that time. It was disastrous for me. They put me with a producer named Anton Fear. I'm sure there's a story behind that. And I realized in the process that A&M was much more invested in their relationship with him.
With Anton, really?
Than with me. He had a production life blooming that was not insignificant in that moment. But
I heard that he yelled at musicians. What I had heard is that he could be a little terse.
Well, he could be, that's putting it really politely. He could be ugly.
Yeah.
He was an addict, and he had addict's behavior.
Yeah.
And I found it a savagely difficult experience. And it was a record I did not connect with in the least musically. It's unlistenable to me in almost every regard. Mm. And he treated David Bromberg horribly. And on my watch, it was deeply embarrassing to me. The whole thing was difficult. But it directly led me to the next record, Shuffletown. That was how I finally met T-Bone. He agreed to be my producer to protect me from A&M. So I could just go kind of set things in motion, put the band together I wanted, which included Don Cherry, the great jazz bassist Cecil McBee, David Mansfield, who had been in the Rolling Thunder Review with T, my great friend from high school, this wonderful jazz pianist from Detroit, Phil Kelly. But it was live to two-track tape. You know, you listen to a playback, that's either the record or it's not the record. And I found myself devoting to it. T-Bone suggested it. He'd made his record for this is called T-Bone Burnett That Way, with a great engineer named Rick Pekonen, who had been the engineer on Electric Warrior for T-Rex. T-Rex was big for me when I was young. Still love them. Part of that pivot, not only to working with T-Bone, but to recording live to two-track tape, was nobody can fucking meddle with this when I'm not in the room. Because everything that's happened has to happen right here and right now.
Yes.
That was deeply resonant for me for the way that I was also writing.
Mm-hmm. Outside your crowded doorway, past the steel and mortar, the avenue, the border, you walk beside yourself and me. How well do you hear me? And what do you recall about the dust on everything you see?
That I saw T-Bone as kind of a shamanistic character. He's a deeply mystical person in my life. He has shown up in ways that kind of defy logical understanding.
But this is framed around you're in
and
New York.
You know
York.
What T-Bone's name is?
No.
His real name is?
No.
It's Joseph Henry Burnett.
Get the fuck out.
That's his name.
His name is Joe Henry.
Joe Henry. I learned that at some point in our early relationship.
So you're still in New York at that point, or had you moved to LA?
I recorded the album in New York. I moved to LA between the time I made it and the time it came out, because Melanie was working at Warner Brother Records as a product manager, international publicist, but she'd never had one aspiration to be in the music business.
To be Madonna's sister working for Warner Brothers in the marketing department is a kind of an interesting space to be.
It was a hard space for her to be. She didn't have any interest there, but Madonna had, you know, the last of the great old school publicists, a woman named Liz Beth Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. And Liz, how else can I say it? She just adored us.
Mm-hmm.
And Melanie came to New York and she got a job working for an organization called CIEE, which coordinated high school exchanges.
I went to Spain on CIEE.
Melanie, as a senior in high school, was a foreign exchange student in Brazil.
Yeah.
So she regards that was life-changing for her. You know, there was her life before Brazil and after Brazil.
Yes.
Just a fact. Things got salty at CIEE, like a lot of, you know, just it just wasn't a happy place for her. Yeah. Because of the woman who was running it at the time. And she just needed a job. And there's Liz Rosenberg who said,
yeah,
hey, I'm going to open a post in New York for an international publicist. Why don't you apply for it? And Mel's like, I don't know anything about the music business. She goes, no, but you speak a few languages and people really like you. And the rest of it, I can teach you. So she just pivoted there out of absolute need.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was unhappy enough in the corporate Warner Brother world, she had been on the road. Brian Eno had a label called Opal, which was under the Warner umbrella, and they managed the artists that were on their roster, which was Brian and John Cale and Harold Budd and Dan Lanois. And she'd been on the road on tour with Dan. I happened to be opening that tour, coincidentally. We were already married at this point, as the Warner rep. And then she gets an offer from Brian Eno. Would you move to LA and co-manage Opal Records in a little bungalow house with the one man who's doing everything right now?
So that's what took you to LA.
Yeah. I was like, well, and I was naive, like, well, I'm signed to A&M and they're in LA.
Yeah.
It'll be nice if I'm closer.
Drop in.
You know, they'll like me being closer. New York had been a hard period for me. My situation with Profile was savage. They abused me terribly. Things weren't going great at A&M. They didn't understand what I wanted to do. Had T-Bone not stepped in, they wouldn't have let that record happen the way that record happened.
I mean, I hear at that time in your career, the sound of the records start to change. They're a little more immediate and sounds like it was leaning in that direction already with T-Bone. But I also wonder if there was just more space in LA, just more headspace.
Well, there was. It was certainly more space for me to write.
Yeah.
I found it very difficult to be a songwriter in a brownstone apartment.
Yeah.
You know, there was this old Italian neighborhood and there was these Italian kids who lived in the garden unit. And I had a spinet piano that shared a wall with the hallway. And I would be in there trying to rub two sticks together, trying to get something going. And I'd start playing the piano and I'd hear these boys, and they'd be on the side of the wall and they go, here he goes.
Oh, no.
You know, or you go down for the mail and, you know, Carmelita, the neighbor, would say, oh, I heard you. It was nice.
Yeah.
I'm like, I thank you, but I don't want anybody hearing any of this. Yeah. I don't even know what this is.
Yeah.
It was hard. And so when Eno offered to take us to LA and pay our moving expenses, we thought, why not give that a whirl for a moment? We never thought we'd be there. We said 2 to 5 years max in Los Angeles. But the big attraction for me, Leo, was that I could drive a car again. I learned to sing by just the one place I could be most completely alone, unselfconsciously, was driving around in a car.
I have to say, thinking about where we've been so far today, you had two crucial songwriting stories that took place in the car.
In motion. I write really well on airplanes, on trains, on buses.
Walking?
Walking will solve almost any musical problem. Anytime I feel stuck, if I take a walk, I come back and I understand what next. So yeah, something about being in motion. So a lot of things happened to me in transit.
When did you leave LA? I
left LA in December of 2020.
December of 2020, so COVID.
Yeah, in COVID. We thought, you know, we've been thinking about moving, getting out of LA. It was just getting hotter and hotter and more expensive, even though I had this deep community there. Yeah. I couldn't afford to keep the Garfield house. It just, you know, the industry had changed so much. I was doing twice the work for a third the money. I understood that it wasn't about just hanging on longer, working harder. I didn't know how to work harder than I was working. So we had a plan to relocate and were looking at all the possibilities. But then I got diagnosed with cancer and so everything stopped. You know, I had to stop working. I didn't know how I was going to fare.
So part of it is actually, if the worst should happen. Where's your family house?
Yeah.
Where do they live?
And how can we think about what the money we had from selling a house to buy another house? You know, we just didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And we didn't feel in any position to make a big decision like that. But primarily in that moment, neither Mel nor I wanted to leave our community. You know, we were deeply invested in real community there.
Sure. 30 years you were there.
31 years ultimately. Yeah. And then there we are in COVID and I'm in remission. I'm stable. We go back to starting planning whatever life we have. So we ended up going to Maine in December of 2020 to oversee the build of a house.
In Portland, Maine.
45 minutes north of Portland in the Finger Islands known as Harpswell.
Had you spent time in Maine?
No.
It's a pretty extreme change.
It is. We were looking all around the East Coast, Hudson Valley, Connecticut. You know, Melanie had always had a dream to live on the sea. Like, where can we live on the sea? Nowhere in California can we afford to live on the sea. But as we're looking all around, Levon and his girlfriend at the time, with whom we are still all close, they had a housemaid in Brooklyn who was from Maine. And when it was weekends or holidays, when there wasn't enough time or resources for Lee and his gal Ellis to come out to California, she's from Berkeley, they started going up to Maine with their housemaid and staying at her parents' farm up there in Topsom, Maine. And we're looking and Levon's like, you guys, Connecticut? You guys aren't Connecticut people. Maine, you guys should go check out Portland. So we made a trip with Lee and Ellis to Portland in October of 2019, peak color weekend of the fall. Fall's my favorite time of the year by a million miles. It's the greatest thing I loved about Michigan, Mel, too. And so there we are. And it feels a lot like Ann Arbor to me to be in Portland, this small, folksy, but very progressive town. And I just said, I can stop looking. I could live. I could make a life here. But we thought we were going to live in the old West End of Portland until we started really. And then COVID made Portland look enormously attractive to people from all over the place.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
New York, LA, you know. And we found ourselves being
priced out of Portland.
Everything, even though I'm thinking, look, we own our house in LA outright. We're going to waltz in here with our LA money and have our way with this joint. Absolutely not. We got outbid on everything. You know, we're offering way over asking, no inspections whatsoever, and losing everything. And we're like, look, this is not about to get better.
Yeah.
It's not about waiting this out. Yeah. But it's a bigger story than I'll tell you how we wound up getting directed by the hand of the universe north in the woods by the water in Harpswell. And building a house, which we'd never even contemplated because we're old house people. And yet that's what happened.
And do you have a little studio space in it or not really?
Yeah, I've got a workspace. Yeah. I did produce my friend John Smith's record there a year before last. It's really just a writing and recording space for me.
Yeah.
Most anything else I would do, I would go out of house for.
Yeah.
But John is a close friend and I kind of wanted to see what I could get away with.
And how do you handle the isolation or the separation? There is none. Well, how so?
I'm just not.
No, I mean the isolation of being in Maine.
Oh, isolation. I thought you
meant. Yeah, Sonic
I was worried about feeling isolated, but I travel enough that when I return, I love the isolation. It's a bit harder on Mel because she's at home more. And I require more solitary time than she does. She's a much more community oriented person in all ways. She's a very collaborative spirit in most every way. Though we do have really dear neighbors who care, who become like our aunt and uncle, we have community and we're building community. But it takes a while for that to happen. Yeah. And it's not been exactly easy.
Sure.
But it's a beautiful place for us to be right now.
Yeah.
I like my proximity to New York again. You know, I take the bus down from Portland.
Oh, wow.
It's really clean, modern bus. And I can get from Portland into Midtown cheaper than I can get an Uber from JFK into Midtown.
Yeah, I believe that.
I get on the bus at 6:30 a.m. It drops me off 42nd and 1st Avenue at about noon.
I mean, Joe, it's also, again, just like meeting in this hotel, it's just like it's such a deeply iconic image of getting off the bus in Port Authority in New York City. I mean, these are just things
at a bus stop on the side of the street.
Yeah.
You wouldn't even know it. I'll get a bus there tomorrow and go back. I mean, I was here in November when I was artist in residence at NYU. It's been kind of wild. I've been collaborating as a songwriter with John Batiste.
Oh, yeah.
The only time we've been in the studio together was when I was here for the NYU thing. And I just let him know because I thought maybe we could have a coffee. And he just said, can you come 2 days early and we can just go into Electric Lady and we can record while we write.
Yeah.
I've never had that experience with it. The idea of recording while we write and, you know, spending the money to be in a room like that while we're conjuring out of nothing. But that was a wholly anomalous and spectacular experience for me.
That is so
ongoing.
Interesting. Right.
He just reached out to me out of the blue. I just got tipped off. This was, you know, back in June or something. Mel and I were about to go out to dinner, and I just see I'm blind copied on an email between my manager and John's manager asking how John can get a hold of me. And I'm looking at that. I'm sitting on the edge of the bed while Mel's getting ready. I'm going, John Batiste? Like that guy? He's trying to get a hold of me. Okay. And the next day, I'm up in my room working, and my phone rings, and this is no ID, which I normally wouldn't answer.
Yeah.
And there he is.
And what had he heard, the work with Alan?
According to him, everything. I said, John, it's lovely hearing from you, but why am I?
Yeah.
He said, because I've been listening to you forever, and I just think we're supposed to be connected.
It's beautiful.
So we talked for like an hour,
hour
and a half. By the end of that call, he said, we need to get together. And I thought he was saying like, yeah, we should get together sometimes. But immediately he started going, well, I mean, I could come to Maine in a couple weeks maybe, or there's these couple of days at the end of August, I'm gonna be back in the city. And I said, well, look, at the end of August, when? Because I have to go do this thing in Chicago. I could just route my trip to Chicago through New York. I can't fly direct from Portland to Chicago anyway. What if I just came in and we just got together? And that's what we did. And I stayed at my sister-in-law's uptown where I normally stay when somebody else is not paying. And at that point, he didn't seem to know that she and I were related, even though he's friendly with her and they've done something together. Unless he was pulling my leg, I just said, look, I have a nice place to stay while I'm in New York. This will be easy. My sister-in-law has a really nice place uptown on the east side. And I said, on 81st Street. He said, where on 81st Street? I told him, he said, is it M? I said, yeah. I mean, you must know that we're... He said, I didn't know, but I was just there. So I know where that is.
Yeah.
We can do that. I said, yeah, there's a piano there. I didn't know what was going to happen. But he showed up, and we just spent 4.5 hours talking.
Yeah.
And then we decided we were going to write together. So I started writing lyrics and texting them to him. And then he said, come down. And we had this crazy experience he had a full band in there. I mean, a horn section even, for things that don't exist. In no way exist. There's this full band. I mean, a horn section, vibes player, his trio. I'm thinking, well, he's got two studios going here. He's got something else going before we're going to get to whatever we're going to get to. I don't in any way compute that this whole setup
is for you.
Is because I'm there. Until I'm sitting in the back of the room of the control room, just sort of checking out the scene. And John's assistant comes in the room. She's looking all over. And then she turns around and sees me. And she goes, oh, John's ready. I said, he's ready. Yeah. So I just go out and I sit on the piano bench with John. While I was sitting there, I just wrote a whole new lyric.
Yeah.
And I had this piece of legal pad that I ripped off sticking out of my notebook. And John, just being John, sees that edge of this thing and he goes, what's that?
Yeah.
I said, just a bunch of words. And he said, when did you write that? I said, sitting here while you were setting up. And he just says, may I? I said, sure. And he reads like a verse of it. And John said, I was going to start with that other thing, but can we just do this? I said, well, do whatever you want. So we're going to, it's almost dark in the studio, except for a few lamps. Very vibey. I sit on the bench with him. He just sits there and looks at the words for a while, like just registering meter, whatever he's... And then he just directs this band by, you know, his physicality, by his laughter, by whoops and yells.
Yeah.
And improvises this like 7-minute bed of music in his head, hearing the cadence of what I've written. He's not singing anything. And this incredible piece of music just happens between all these cats. And all of it with almost unbroken eye contact between us. Which if you think about looking at somebody that is kind of new in your life.
Yeah.
Like this.
Yeah, like we're doing, yeah.
Like for like 7 minutes.
Yeah.
You get to the end of it and he says, he didn't say, what do you think? He says, what do you feel?
Mm.
I said, I feel like it's all in the room. He said, should we listen? I said, well, we could. Or we could just play it again because it seems like it's here. He said, okay, let's play it again. He turns back around, and he doesn't, it's not like another take of that. Just something wholly other happens. And we go in finally to listen to that, and that's what I really understand from all the response to all these musicians, that they're there because I'm there. Not like they haven't been doing other things, but this is what's happening. I mean, this goes on for 2 nights. I think we did like 5 things, which we need to return to and sort out melody and him sing.
Structure.
Which we tried to connect to this trip. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But John is doing everything in the world right now.
Yes.
Everything. I'm just waiting for whenever the stars align and we will return.
Yeah. It is a story about total presence. I mean, it's actually related to the story you tell about what you think the fundamental job of production is for you, which is to, when you are in the space, whenever that is, to be fully in the space.
Absolutely. Total presence.
Yeah.
That is the code of my road.
Yes. The code of my road.
As much as I can keep myself there. And of course, the me of 10 years ago might have been insecure enough that I've thought, I wish Jay was here. I wish I could stack the deck. But at this point, I had coffee with an old friend from South Pasadena who happened to be visiting her daughter in town here. And I was getting coffee immediately across the street from Electric Lady right before the session at 5 p.m. And I said to her as I got up, I said, I'm going to walk through that door over there now. And I don't have one fucking idea what's about to happen to me. And I could not be happier about that.
Yeah.
All relationships I do not have.
That's how I felt walking here today with you. I'm going to walk into this room and I have no idea what we're going to talk about. I mean, it is similar in that sense. Like
The night before we started with Bright Mississippi with Alan Toussaint.
Yeah.
He asked to meet me at the Russian Tea Room.
Huh.
He loved going there. And he was all nervous and he finally just said, so tomorrow, what's going to happen? And I said, Alan, I have no idea, but I know it will be beautiful.
Yeah.
I just know it will be. It's music that we all care about. Every musician who's coming is excited to be in support of you. And there's no way that we don't find our way to beauty.
Yeah.
And what form that takes, I can't tell you. And I don't want to know. It does not help me to think I know.
Well, if you think you know, then you could fail.
Yeah.
But if you don't think you know,
then whatever happens is what happened.
Yeah.
And I'm in the business of what happened.
Yeah. All right. So I know that early on in your career, you used the label alt country, and there were times when that maybe you felt it didn't serve you, but putting labels on what you're doing is hard. And it is hard because you're as moved by these jazz influences as you are by country and
like
by
I love folk. Edith Piaf like I love Hank Williams.
Well, this Edith Piaf thing is going to derail my argument a little bit. But
continue.
But I guess what I was thinking is like what I think you are is an American storyteller. I think, you know, you made a point of saying that you were focused on telling stories. They didn't have to be autobiographical. As a matter of fact, better if they're not.
Yeah.
But they are kind of all American. They're all borrowing from the American fabric. And I think that you, probably unintentionally, although maybe you have been aware of it, have been kind of devoted to telling American stories. And in fact, songs are some of the most primary ways that we have as a country, told ourselves who we are and what we care about.
For better or worse, I'm a deeply American informed person and artist. That's absolutely true, Leo. And I know that that is the imagery I lean into. I was conflicted about my Southern upbringing.
Yeah.
I still find myself writing about
and
using imagery that is decidedly Southern and old world in that way. And I extend that same thought to how I think of myself as an American. It's an accident of my birth, but it was a real one.
Yes. The reason I frame the question around that is because we are engaged right now in a rewriting of what the American story is. I mean, it's happening moment by moment.
It is happening.
As we speak.
Yeah.
By the time I edit this and put it up, countless new infractions and
I could be in jail by then.
So that's the question. I mean, you have a lifetime of songs behind you. If you never write another song again, it will still be true. But what do you think it means to be an American songwriter today and to tell American stories given the current context?
I think as artists, every one of us has a responsibility to pay attention and to be engaged, to be a part of the resistance, however we find our way to articulate that. I don't know what we do other than whatever we can. And that's going to look different for everybody. And we're going to be asking ourselves the question daily, what can I do? For me, when I started out, Leo, I promise you, I never thought about talking about politics from stage. I didn't talk at all. I admired artists who were not in the business of explaining anything on stage.
Dylan.
Whether Bob or Van or Miles, you don't explain your songs. You just, the music speaks. Until at such time, Melanie really challenged me.
Hmm.
She said, you know, you have so much to say about what you do and how you do it in an interview, or but when you get in front of the people who have shown themselves to care the most about what it is you do, you don't offer them any of it. Why don't you offer them something?
Yes.
And that same show I described before, I think when I played Reverie in Total, I said, all right, I'm going to do a little experiment. When I play tomorrow night, I'm going to have something to say before every song, either about the song or it doesn't even need to be. I will find something to say and I'm going to see what that feels like. And I did. I kind of loosely scripted some idea of what I could say in segue to whatever was coming next musically. And of course, people were as responsive to what I said as anything I sang. I couldn't miss that. And I understood at that point, I'd been holding on to somebody else's idea of how to do what it is that I do.
Yeah.
And that I didn't have to, if I didn't want to, I didn't have to stay in that particular posture. I could decide that what's authentic to me right now is, I know that my songs are difficult for some people.
Yeah.
For a lot of people. They may like them and be
challenged.
And challenged by them. And so I ultimately concluded, like a new song is like a pair of tight new shoes. And if I'm standing here holding a shoehorn that might help you into this tight new pair of shoes, what kind of person am I if I won't hand it over?
I had a thought earlier when you were saying how you and Madonna are not in the same business or don't have the same job.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think your job has been to sort of mine the American experience or the experience of whatever. Like there's a deep relationship with the past that comes forward in your songs to me sometimes.
Yeah.
And her job has been mostly to mine the present and turn it into the future.
Yeah.
But either way, it's kind of like dipping the cup into the river and turning it into something. And the reason I say that is because you had this moment that I alluded to at the beginning of the conversation where you had written a lyric and it was kind of a moody tango.
It was more than a lyric. It was a
song.
It was a full song and I had demoed it. We had just moved house and I'd set up my new studio in a little guest house in South Pasadena before Garfield House. I'm sorry, I just...
Yeah, no, you know where I'm going. You can pick it up.
And the best way, after I got set up and wired in, the best way to see if everything was working was just record anything.
Yeah.
Just and see where, you know, where there was a problem. Yeah. I could have just decided for the sake of getting on with it to just record a cover of something.
Yeah.
But I had this fragment and I just quickly finished it. I mean, when I say quickly, I mean in about 20 minutes, literally, so that I had something to record. And I brought Melanie out to play her this so she could kind of, my thinking was, you know, hear what's going on in this room, what it sounds like to be in this room hearing music.
It sounds like you run a lot of work by her, that she's part of the process.
I mean, yes and no. I don't play her stuff necessarily in progress, but I will play her a recording of something differently than I'm sitting
at the guitar. Yeah.
And so I played her this thing and I'm just thinking if she's going to respond to sound. And she said, I've never said this before. I've never had this thought before, but I can really hear Madonna singing this song. And I said, this one? I said, look, she said, she's in England. She's in London making a record right now. And I said, well, look, if I was going to pitch a song to her, it wouldn't be this one. And she said, well, burn a copy for me and I'll send it to her. I said, knock yourself out. I burned a CD, she FedExed it.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell the wind not to blow. 'Cause you said so.
24 hours later, my phone rings. And it's my sister-in-law. She said, "What's happening with the song? What are you doing with the song?" I said, "What am I doing with it? It's just, it's a song on the pile.
Yeah.
That's all it is." And she said, "Can I play around with it?" I said, "Sure, of course you can." And then I didn't hear anything back. I just assumed that she didn't get to it or it didn't come together. Months went by. And then I'm texting with her, I think on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. She's in London. I'm in California. And she said, "Oh, by the way, I can't wait for you to hear your song. I think you'll really like it." And I really said, "What song?" Because that song that you sent me. And I changed the title, by the way. This is the first I know that she's actually done something.
So she changed it to "Don't Tell Me." That's the song it's called. Remind me your title originally.
Stop.
Stop. But it's the lyric is the same.
Unchanged.
Tell the leaves not to turn. Just don't tell me, I'll learn. Take the black off a crow. But don't tell me.
It was a great lesson for me as a songwriter to realize that I'm thinking that my writing is too obtuse to connect with a large audience. But when she was touring that record and we went to see her down in Orange County somewhere, Anaheim, I think, when she's touring the album Music that Don't Tell Me is on, she comes out for that song, dismisses everybody. It's the only time that like all the effects, the computer stops. And it's her and her guitar player, two acoustic guitars and a boombox, sitting on stools. And it's the first time that she's not following a script.
Yeah.
We're like in the second row. She looks down at me and she goes, "This is for you." Does the song. 30,000 people sing along to every word of this fucking thing. And I realize it's not the words, it's the delivery system. People don't have any problem with this if it's delivered like this.
Yeah.
Go figure. Took me a while for that to really resonate.
Right. Maybe you're not as obtuse as you think.
But that's how it won't matter. If people are made to feel a certain way, they don't need it to literally translate.
Yeah.
It's like back to Edith Piaf. Yeah. Listen, I listen to a lot of people who don't sing in English.
Yeah.
And what I really love about it is I'm such a word geek. It's liberating to go back to the idea of just hearing a human voice as an instrument.
Yes.
So I listen to, whether it's Edith or it's Caetano Veloso or Gaucho Gil or Caruso.
Yeah.
It's really important for me to be reminded of what just viscerally happens when human beings give voice. And we have such a narrow idea in our culture. We say all the time, "Oh, that person can really sing," which means there are people who can't sing, which actually translates to shouldn't sing. But it's the most human impulse in the world. And we limit ourselves to like an incredible experience of musicality because we decide that some people like, you know,
have it,
you know, have it. And it's like, okay, well, so why is that person who's got this outrageous range and why does Whitney Houston so often leave me completely cold?
Sure.
And Mississippi John Hurt, who had like a 5-note range.
Yeah. Or Tom Waits.
It's fucking killing me.
Yeah.
Explain this to me.
Yeah.
Because it's their humanity, and that's what fires anybody. So when I heard Madonna do that, and I witnessed it, what the word said was not inhibiting anybody's visceral human experience, because they were having a Madonna kind of human experience, and it was not a problem.
Joe Henry, man, thank you for your generosity. I really get a sense of how present and generous you are of spirit and of yourself in a lot of rooms just by spending this time with you today. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, you're welcome. I appreciate you caring about what I do.
The Third Story is hosted, produced, and mixed by me, Leo Sidran. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.